My name is Mark Hollingsworth. I'm the author of a book called Londongrad, From Russia with Cash, The Inside Story of the Oligarchs, which focuses on the activities of the Russian oligarchs who made billions of dollars in the 1990s when President Yeltsin was in power, and then how they moved their money out of Russia via offshore networks. And most of it arrived in London, hence the title of the book, Londongrad. So I specialize in investigating Russian oligarchs and their financial and political networks, but not just oligarchs from Russia, but also from Ukraine and oligarchs from all over the world, really.
Now, this whole concept of oligarchs, now, can you explain where they came from? Because what were they part of the Soviet era? Because they certainly seem to have got rocket boosters under them when it came to the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, so during the Cold War and in the 1980s, there were different kinds of oligarchs, which were mainly KGB officers. And so there's a lot of black market trading, a lot of cash being moved out of the Soviet Union, and a lot of secret bank accounts controlled by KGB officers in the 1980s before the end of the Soviet Union. And so, to that extent, and it's documented a lot in the book called Putin's People by Catherine Belton, if people are interested in that story. But the word oligarch, it may be worth explaining what it means. It comes from the Greek. What it actually means is businessmen who make a lot of money, become wealthy through political manipulation and political influence and exploiting either corrupt politicians or where governments privatize state assets. So there's basically wealth through political influence and exploitation of a weak government, really. And that's where the word oligarch means. Just because you're rich doesn't necessarily make you an oligarch. So I think that's worth clarifying.
Well, look, the implication here is that you're getting political protection of some sort.
Yes, in Russia they have this word that it means roof, and it's called. There is a Russian word, and the translation of it is roof.
It's Krisha, I think, isn't it?
Krisha, you're quite right, is the
Yeah.
word.
I mean,
It's
everyone
word
needs their
for
Krisha.
roof.
I think the same is true in journalism sometimes. You want someone protecting you.
And what it means is that you need to build a roof over your wealth. In terms of you make your money, often in the 1990s it was through corruption and manipulation of the Russian state when Yeltsin was president, and how a small group of Russian oligarchs became very rich very quickly by manipulating President Yeltsin. And they sold off very valuable state assets for barely a 10% of their real value. But they also needed to protect that wealth. And so that's where they needed to have compliant politicians and to move the money out of Russia to protect it. And so there was a sort of protection racket going on. It was not just businessmen making lots of money, it was a whole network of political manipulation and making sure that your money and your wealth was safe. And so they didn't invest it back into Russia or give it to Russian charities or help Russian people. They moved the money abroad to secure it and keep it safe.
If you go back to the Yeltsin era, I mean, there was obviously a lots and lots of infrastructure in this managed economy. Almost all of the infrastructure in Russia was state-owned, or the industries were state-owned, and the oligarchs were in the process of selling it off. But I mean, I would imagine that they needed some sort of training and finance to do that. Where did that come from?
Well, some of the oligarchs did have some expertise in understanding business, understanding the oil industry. I mean, quite a few of them didn't. The exception was probably Roman Abramovich, who was an oil trader in the early 90s. And he understood the oil business and the whole process of refining the oil and selling it and trading it. He had been an oil trader for a company in Switzerland. So he understood the value of oil. And so what happened in his case was that there was a very valuable oil fields in Russia. He got together, Abramovich got together with another oligarch called Boris Berezovsky, who was very close to President Yeltsin. And Berezovsky was more of a political animal. He was a businessman. He had made a lot of money himself through privatization, particularly in the car industry and other businesses. But the two got together, and Abramovich identified the oil fields, which were incredibly valuable. And Berezovsky ensured that the auctions that took place were in their favor. And in simple terms, they were able to obtain assets, oil fields throughout Russia for only 100 million. And those assets were worth several billion. I mean, certainly 3 or 4 billion. And they got it for 100 million. And they borrowed that 100 million to buy. To basically to benefit from those state assets which were privatized to them. And I think even some of that 100 million that they paid, some of that money was borrowed even from the state assets, even from state banks. So it was, as they say, the sale of the century, and Abramovich and Berezovsky became very rich very quickly, and they set up this company called Sibneft. And you know, that was the main deal that made Abramovich so wealthy. And they could only do it through influencing President Yeltsin, who went along with mainly American and Western economists who said they needed to privatize everything quickly. The Russian economy was in bad shape. They needed to sell off all these state assets. The problem is they sold them off on the cheap. And so that's how these oligarchs made so much money so quickly.
Well, look, I can remember looking into the 1999 apartment bombings in Moscow a few years ago. This is at the time that Putin was taking over from Yeltsin. In fact, I think even in 99, he was some kind of like deputy prime minister or deputy president. I'm not sure exactly what his role was, but or maybe an interim, as Yeltsin was having loads of trouble hanging on to power. But Berezovsky apparently was involved in that. But he, the most thing, famous thing, I think, in many people don't realize, in Russia, he was well known for. Berezovsky was the first ever private TV channel in Russia, which was NTV, and he was doing quite a lot of digging around when there was terrorist attacks, the Chechen War, and this sort of thing. So this is another major aspect to the oligarchs. People don't necessarily realize is they have a kind of Murdoch-like influence in the 1990s in Russia, as the country was opening up to the West. These people were extremely powerful. In fact, they were involved, I suppose, Berezovsky specifically, in almost charting that through his TV channel.
Yes, you have to remember that in Russia, most people during, you know, during the Soviet Union and to this day and during the 90s get their information from TV. And that may obviously have changed more recently because of the internet and online and social media and websites, etc. But up until certainly 1997, 98, when email came in, until then, most Russian people got their information from TV stations, and you're quite right. Berezovsky owned NTV, and he was a media oligarch as much as anything else, and he was very interested in political influence, and he was much more interested in being a sort of political manipulator and power than actually business. He was obviously very wealthy, but he was much more the political operator than he was an entrepreneur.
So, to what extent were the oligarchs you mentioned voluntarily coming to London, or did they find that once Putin had arrived, it was a little bit too hot to remain in Russia?
So when Berezovsky challenged Putin, there was a famous incident in terms of a Russian, I think a submarine that sank, and there were terrible deaths and
Oh,
casualties.
this is the Kursk
And
incident, yeah?
exactly, yeah. And Putin was very complacent and didn't seem to care about the deaths of these Russian sailors, and understandably their parents were very upset and went public, and Berezovsky's TV channel was very critical of Putin, and this was the beginning of the end for Berezovsky, and Putin was very angry that he's being criticized by Berezovsky's TV channel, so he started launching investigations into Berezovsky, and it was the sort of beginning of the end, and he was warning Berezovsky to stop critical media coverage of his administration. And so Berezovsky realized that he needed to leave Russia, and he moved. Basically, he was in his chateau in the south of France, and decided to stay there, and then he moved to London. And then that was about 2000, 2001. And then another oligarch with Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's the owner of Yukos Oil and much wealthier, he challenged Putin and was very critical of Putin and corruption in Russia. And he went public about it, and he started funding opposition groups. And he was very arrogant and naive. And then in 2003, Khodorkovsky got arrested and was in jail for 10 years. So around that sort of period, we're looking at 2000 to 2004, the other oligarchs realized that they had to secure their wealth.
So
And
just
so
to
they
stop you a
started.
second, Mark, because the Kursk incident was literally just after Putin had become president. And up until that point, Berezovsky had been supporting him. So this must have been a
Yes.
really big falling out, almost like, here's the guy I wanted to be president, and now he's criticizing me. So Putin had kind of turned the tables on him to a certain extent.
Yes, definitely. And Berezovsky also, I think, felt that he, in a way, he was the senior of the two, in terms of he was like a puppet master, and he thought that Putin was just a bureaucrat and a apparatchik. He had been head of the Russian intelligence security service, the FSB, but relatively speaking, Putin had come from a very modest political background. He was regarded as a grey man, and Berezovsky thought he could control and manipulate him, and obviously made a huge mistake. And so he realized that Putin was going to prosecute him, put him in jail, and that's why he moved to London. And so it was a huge error of judgment.
So
And
when did he
Khodorkovsky
come?
made the same mistake.
Yeah, well, when did he come to London, and why London?
Around about 2001, I think he came to London. And I think it's important to know why the oligarchs moved to London, why they moved their assets and wealth and managed in London. And it's very simple. Well, the main reason is that they knew from their lawyers that if they were in London and Putin and the Russian state wanted to extradite them back to Russia for tax evasion, money laundering, fraud, and various criminal charges, they knew that they were safe in London. The judges in London would never extradite them back to Moscow, because the judges here would rule that if they were sent back to Moscow, they would never get a fair trial, because there's no the judiciary in Russia is very politicized, it's arbitrary, it's corrupt, and you just don't get a fair trial. It's completely run by the state, and there's no rule of law in Russia, certainly particularly in the commercial field. And so that's the main reason they stayed in London. If they went to France or Switzerland or Spain or Italy, there was always a slight danger of criminal prosecutions. They have a different judicial system there. And in America, there's a lot more regulation of their finances, and they'd be under more scrutiny. London has always been regarded as a soft touch for financial crooks, basically. And so the regulation here is lighter, it's softer, and also they prefer the lifestyle. There's lots of reasons why they preferred London. And that's when Berezovsky moved in 2001, and that's why other oligarchs started to move from sort of 2003 onwards. As soon as Khodorkovsky was arrested, they knew they had to move their money out of Russia and keep it safe.
Okay, so with Berezovsky in London, I mean, he and many of these people, they would want to continue some political influence, wouldn't they? I mean, they've been used to that over in Russia. Did they manage to get any? I know though, Berezovsky particularly was quite close to, was it, I think, the Duke of Kent, who was a Russian speaker.
Princess Michael, yeah, the Russian oligarchs were definitely interested in political influence in the UK, but they didn't understand the UK, the British political system. They thought that the House of Lords ran the country or the royal family ran the country.
Oh, yes,
They
so they
just didn't
better be careful
understand
they don't tread on any toes, eh?
it. Exactly. And so he got close to Prince Michael of Kent, who's a member of the royal family. Who actually looks like Tsar Nicholas II, and he speaks perfect Russian, has a lot of Russian ancestry, but he didn't, and he paid quite a lot of relatively amount of money in consultancy fees to Prince Michael of Kent, and never quite understood where real political power in the UK lay. But he certainly tried. I think some members of the House of Lords were on the payroll or became directors or consultants of Russian companies. And Berezovsky certainly had a relationship with the British state. It's not quite clear the depth of that. He certainly spoke, had meetings with MI5, and was some kind of asset or informant. As part of the deal to keep
You know,
safe in London.
I'm going to guess that he possibly was chatting with MI6 as well, who might be interested in some of the contacts he had back in Russia.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. He was definitely some kind of informant, and that was part of the deal that he would be protected in London if he acted as some kind of intelligence asset or certainly as an informant. He was never formally recruited. Because there was at least one, I'm sure there were several assassination attempts orchestrated by the Kremlin against Berezovsky. He was public enemy number one because he was so vocal in his criticism of Putin.
Yeah,
And
so
so,
things started going wrong for Berezovsky, didn't they? And eventually he ended up being found dead in his house. So what happened there?
well, he lasted about 12 years in London, and he was very active. But he spent a huge amounts of money funding opposition groups. I mean, even at one stage, was building like a ship which had cannons and guns attached to it. And he was very deluded. He thought that he could organize like a coup against Putin. But he was spending more and more money, and he would finance opposition groups in Ukraine, anyone who is opposed to Putin. I think in 2006, when Litvinenko was murdered, that gave him more of a platform. But he was gradually becoming less and less influential. And then he lost his lawsuit when he sued Abramovich. But he was definitely the public enemy number one.
So
And so
why
anyway,
did
after
Abramovich and Berezovsky fall out? How did that happen?
because when Berezovsky moved to the UK, he still had substantial assets and shareholdings in Russian companies, notably the NTV media company. And so Abramovich came to see him around about 2001, soon after he moved to the West, and was basically an emissary on behalf of Putin, and basically wanted him to sell all his assets at a knockdown price to Abramovich, was effectively to the Russian state, and he reluctantly agreed. But later on, he felt that he was manipulated and There was a sort of fraudulent misrepresentation. So he sued Abramovich in the High Court and he lost. He was a terrible witness, very arrogant, didn't prepare himself. And that case ended in about 2011. And that was kind of the beginning of the end for Berezovsky, really. And he was going through divorces, he was running out of money. And although that is some dispute. And so, however, he was still a thorn in the side of Putin. And then in 2013, he was found dead in one of his houses in Surrey, in the bar in the bathroom, and it appeared that he had hung himself in his bathroom in one of his houses in Surrey. And so it's never been proven either way. The jury's out in terms of whether he was murdered.
So, well,
That's what
what
we
it must have
come
been an
to.
inquest. What did that have to say?
It didn't go either way. I think it was an inconclusive verdict. I'm not sure if the jury said there was foul play, but it didn't rule it out, if that makes sense. So I think it certainly was suspicious. There've been other murders of Russians in the UK, which, you just because a Russian dies in the UK doesn't mean to say he was murdered by the Kremlin. So you have to take each case on its own merits. But I think from what I've read and what I've been told, and I've spoken to people who are very close to Berezovsky, I know people who work for him and was very close to him, and I would say majority think there was foul play and that he was murdered, but no one's ever been able to really provide clear evidence of it. It's just certainly very suspicious.
An open verdict is what they say. 67 years old, he was found on the bathroom floor of his Ascot home with a ligature around his neck. So some kind of suicide. But the coroner said he couldn't prove beyond all reasonable doubt that he took his own life or was unlawfully killed. So yeah, an open verdict.
I mean, people are saying it's a strange way to kill yourself. I mean, I don't know enough about suicide,
Well, I mean, and
but
also you've got to look at the sort of person he was. He had quite a powerful ego, but then again, he'd lost almost everything. He'd lost a lot of the things that he came to London with, had gone. Okay, so what do you think? Is there a, why do you think he ended up? This is like the chief oligarch of an amazing era in the 1990s ends up dead in London. And I mean, did that have an effect on other oligarchs? Did you know, or what was the sort of ramifications of what happened to
Well,
Berezovsky?
there've been other, yes, there've been other murders or other deaths, rather, of other wealthy Russians in the UK, and I think that in 2013 was, like a sentence was, I think it meant that. Well, obviously, oligarchs increased their security. I think other oligarchs were less likely to come to London. You also had the murder of Litvinenko in 2006. There was another Russian. There's quite a few suspicious deaths of either Russians or people who worked for oligarchs. And so I think it was increasingly a place less likely to move your. But it didn't really that it didn't really change until the Ukraine war in 2022. I think it was a gradual, to some extent, decline. But at the end of the day, the whole story of Londongrad and the point about the Russian oligarchs in London is it's really about money and securing your wealth and assets. That is the number one priority. But I think they started to feel less safe on the security side. You had the Skripal murder, and there just seems to be more and more suspicious deaths in the UK.
I mean, in your book, Mark, it talks about these buccaneering oligarchs, but aren't they actually just really political crooks, totally corrupt?
Yes, I mean, there's a debate in terms of how you define them, because technically, theoretically, there was no sort of anti-corruption law in Russia in the 1990s. Technically, and I stress the word technically and theoretically, they didn't actually break any laws because there was no criminal law against what they did. I mean, they did it through manipulation. There was a lot of evidence of some of the auctions for these very valuable assets being rigged, and basically by bribing and influencing the chairman of the auction court in terms of who was given the license to buy, these very valuable state assets in oil, aluminium, gas. I mean, these people, managed to secure the ownership to buy these, literally buy these aluminium plants and gas fields and oil fields for 10, 20% of their real value. So it was a real rip-off. And I think by any judge and by any stance, it was criminal. It was certainly totally unjust and immoral, given the certainly the level of poverty in Russia as well. These state assets belong to the Russian people. They didn't believe belong to these tiny number of manipulators and opportunists.
Well, no, I mean, we sometimes forget the Russian people were running out of food. Some are starving at the time.
Exactly. I mean, people forget that there's still a huge amount of poverty in Russia. There always has been, and there still is. And unfortunately, people who are struggling economically and are living in poverty, they often tend to look for a strong man, a tough guy who they think will look after them and look after their interests. And this is, I think, why Putin has had so much political support in Russia. I mean, I'm not a political scientist, but I think there's a lot of truth in that. And unfortunately, they didn't identify the root cause of their poverty was that, Russia is a country with huge natural resources, and the billions and billions of dollars that were accumulated by this tiny number of Russian oligarchs, obviously for obvious reasons, could have been used to improve, social services and just the infrastructure of Russian towns and cities. And instead, a lot of the money was laundered offshore, went via bank accounts in Cyprus and into offshore companies and offshore trusts in the Caribbean and Gibraltar, and ended up, a lot of it ended up in London or just hidden away. So, it was a real scam.
Well, some people in places like Newcastle, Middlesbrough might argue the same, that the resources were being squandered and not spent, and infrastructure here in this country too. But what about, you mentioned Kolomoisky, Khodorkovsky. Can you just take us through a few names of some other oligarchs?
Well, in terms of the Russian oligarchs, the most famous is obviously Roman Abramovich, until recently owner of Chelsea. I spoke about him earlier. He's a very smart guy. I mean, he understood the oil industry and, opportunist, didn't get involved in politics, understood that he had to keep in with Putin, was very close to him. And so, arguably, Putin's favorite oligarch. And then, obviously, we talked about Berezovsky. Khodorkovsky, who went to jail in 2003, was in jail for 10 years, basically for challenging Putin and accusing the Kremlin of corruption. A man called Oleg Deripaska, who also quite famous, very close to Putin and the Kremlin, made a lot of money through privatization of the aluminium and oil and natural resources and oil and gas. He's had a UK presence in terms of assets here. He became very close to Lord Mandelson, and was quite active politically as well.
And also Nat Rothschild, I think.
There was a situation, I think, in 2008 where, from memory, Deripaska hosted a party on his yacht in Corfu, and the guests included Mandelson, Nat Rothschild, and some conservative politicians. It was when I think Cameron was prime minister, I think, or maybe not. It was actually Gordon Brown. I'm trying to remember. Maybe I think Gordon Brown was prime minister at the time, but the Conservative Party were trying to raised money, and George Osborne was Shadow Chancellor. He was on the yacht. It was a big scandal because it was alleged by Nat Rothschild, who was an advisor to Deripaska, that the Conservative politicians were trying to solicit donations from Deripaska. And Deripaska is quite controversial because he had major problems traveling to the US. He was always being stopped going into US. He had because his visa, the FBI and the immigration were constantly questioning his immigration, his visa status, and the investigations into Deripaska. So he's been quite controversial. And
Yeah,
yeah, there are a
you
lot
get
of
the idea, don't
screws
you?
that
That
make.
these politicians, they are looking for they will go anywhere to get a donation, including sometimes to people ill repute. Anyway, I'm sorry to stop you. It's interesting to go through some of these names again, and also maybe to look at Ukraine, and because Ukraine had its own bunch of oligarchs.
People forget that before the Ukraine war, there was just as many Ukrainian oligarchs, and often some of them just as controversial and just as wealthy, and had obtained their wealth through privatization of very valuable natural resources in Ukraine. And they did the same thing. So, for example, there was a Ukrainian oligarch called Akhmatov, and he made a lot of money, and he did the usual thing, and he moved it to the UK, and he spent 100 million in London just on two flats at a place called One Hyde Park. So they were luxury apartments, penthouse on One Hyde Park in Knightsbridge. So that gives an example of the amount of wealth that the Ukrainian oligarchs had. And you had other people, who were Ukrainians, Blavatnik, and other Ukrainians, Kolomoisky, who became very close to President Zelensky. And so the Ukrainian business men were no angels, and there was just as much manipulation and influence peddling in Ukraine as there was in Russia. And so Ukraine is far from a corruption-free zone.
No, definitely not. Well, look, bringing us right up to date, are there any of these oligarchs still around, active in London, Mark? And if we wanted to go and see if we can raise a few bob from them, where do they hang out?
Well, because of the sanctions that were imposed against the Russian oligarchs at the beginning of the Ukraine war in 2022, I would say 90% of them, if not 100%, of the Russian oligarchs in London have basically left, and they've either moved to Moscow or Israel or anywhere apart from London, because there have been sanctions, so their assets have been frozen, and literally they have no bank account. They cannot. The bank accounts in the UK, their properties, their assets, their companies, their investments, all have been frozen. So what that means is they have no access to funds. The only oligarch who stayed in the UK was a man called Mikhail Friedman, who is one of the big billionaire oligarchs. He never thought that he would be sanctioned. He stayed. To be fair to him, he was not an oligarch that was particularly close to Putin, and he thought, look, I don't spend time with Putin. I have no, he was not one of those political oligarchs, if that makes sense. He made money from privatization in the 90s, but he was much more of an entrepreneur, more of a genuine businessman. Anyway, and he never thought he'd be sanctioned. He owned that huge, amazing house in Highgate. And but he was sanctioned. He stayed. He tried to stay in London. He eventually gave up. He's back in Moscow. So I'm afraid if you want to hang out with the oligarchs, they're not in London anymore. And
Maybe Tel Aviv.
their properties have been sanctioned. What that means is that technically they still own those assets. They own the properties, but they can't sell them, and they can't financially benefit
Well,
from
could they
the.
live there if they wanted to?
Yes, they could technically, and Friedman did live in that house I mentioned. I think it's called Athlone House up in Highgate. It's an amazing property, and Usmanov another big time oligarch. His house was just down the street. It's all in that sort of Highgate, Hampstead area. And so they technically still own those properties, but they've been the owner has been frozen, so they just can't sell them. So even if you had, if you, Tony, sold your house and you sold this online business and you made a few million, you still couldn't buy that house. So because of the nature of the law, it's frozen, literally.
So your book is Londongrad from Russia with Cash, Inside Story of the Oligarchs. Whereabouts do people follow you and find you, Mark?
Well, I don't use social media, but the easy way to do it is to simply go on my website, which is www.markhollingsworth.co.uk, and you'll find all my books on Amazon, and I write for all the newspapers, so I'm pretty easy to find.
Okay, Mark Hollingsworth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.